This is Jenna Walker from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from two different sources. One is the Triangle Business Journal Viewpoint, and the remainder of my reading will be from NerdWallet. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency. Serving the community since 1974, they can be reached at 919-781-1973. Again, that's 919-781-1973. Today I'll start with from the editor's notebook, a viewpoint of the Triangle Business Journal. The author is Saguda Mukherjee, is the editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. At exactly 8:30 a.m. on April 12, the U.S. government announced the Consumer Price Index, CPI, commonly known as the indicator of inflation, jumped 8.5% in March. The reaction from many noted economists was, meh, we expected that. Maybe, but it's the highest year-over-year jump since 1981. Although back then, the Dow Jones Average Industrial was hovering around 800. Today, it's around 34,000. But when it comes to overheating of the economy, we must first look at housing. Now, the overheating of the housing market, it's taking its toll on at least one industry, mortgage firms. With interest rates higher than 5% for a 30-year fixed mortgage, refinancing has dried up considerably, and new mortgage applications are coming down appreciatively. In other words, the same companies in the home financing business that in the past 3 years have done remarkably well financially and expanded to hundreds of cities nationwide are now in a bind. National companies such as Better.com and Movement Mortgage have already announced layoffs in thousands, and chances are hundreds of similar mortgage outfits across the country will either close up shop or merge, with another company to keep the lights on. GoPrime Mortgage founder Jim Rogers said in the past few days that to survive, one needs to adjust and cut costs, adding the overheated housing market ripple effect may become much wider if policymakers do not pay attention to the macro winds. In a paper published just days ago under the umbrella of the Federal Reserve of Dallas, the author opined that the real-time monitoring of housing market points to a brewing bubble. But thankfully, the author added at the bottom of his note, based on the present evidence, there's no expectation that fallout from the housing correction would be comparable to 2007 to 2009 global financial crisis in terms of magnitude or macroeconomic gravity. Among other things, household balance sheets appear in better shape. Balance sheet and excessive borrowing doesn't appear to be fueling the housing boom. And here lies my worry. Will we manufacture a cottage industry of financiers who will prey on unsuspecting home buyers or homeowners when the housing market cools down appreciably? Given the mortgage rates have now crossed 5% for a 30-year fixed loan, and some say it'll be at 6% later this year, demand will surely take a dive along with the dwindling inventory. But there are still enough people out there right now willing to outbid other prospective buyers over one house. With Americans carrying bigger debt loads, far higher than last year, and financial institutions becoming more wary to finance a pipeline of contracts, the economic slowdown may happen sooner than later. That may be a good thing for some, may be a good thing because none of these macro indicators are sustainable. There's a crash and burn economics. Economics Roundtable did an eye-opening study last year that compared the potential impact of homelessness because of the current trend. The current environment is projected for chronic homelessness to increase 49% in the U.S., the study notes. We will go through this up and down cycle until the housing supply matches the demand. The government assistance programs will be reserved for people in real need rather than sending stimulus checks in the mail to everyone. The Federal Reserve is likely to even be more aggressive to fight inflation in the coming months. Let's hope the policy shows some results. Next, I thought I would read an article from NerdWallet. The author is Benjamin Din, D-I-N. It's from April 29, 2022, and it's called Broker Check Explained. If you're looking for information about a specific broker or brokerage firm, Broker Check is a good place to start. Broker Check is a free service that allows you to investigate the records of brokers and brokerage firms. It also provides some basic information on investment advisors, representatives, and their firms. Regulatory non-governmental organization that oversees U.S. broker-dealers to help investors assess the standings and work history of the individuals and firms they are, or are considering getting into business with Broker Check. You can find information about a broker, including credentials, qualifications, employment history, and disciplinary events. Broker Check information comes primarily from two databases, depending on what type of information you're looking for. The Central Registry Depository Program is administered by FINRA. The database includes details listed on registration and licensing forms filled out by regulators and brokers and brokerage firms. The Investment Advisor Public Disclosure Database, IAPD, is from the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it includes information about investment advisor firms and representatives, such as employment history and disciplinary events. Advisors submit their findings through the SEC Online Investment Advisor Registration Depository System. Broker Check allows you to quickly research brokers, advisors, and firms. To look up an individual, all you need is their name. You can also include the name of their firm and where they're located to narrow down the search. Similarly, to look up a firm, all you need is its name. If you want, you can also include its location. Once you find the individual or firm you're looking for, you can generate a Broker Check report for free. Reports for brokers. On Broker Check, you can find information about brokers who are currently registered with FINRA or a national securities exchange, as well as brokers whose registrations have been terminated. For a registered broker or one who has been registered in the last 10 years, the report will provide a summary about the broker and their credentials, registration and employment history, detailing registered security firms where they have been or registered, as well as where they've worked. Work history includes self-employment, military service, and unemployment, as well as all full and part-time work, even if it wasn't in the industry in the past decade. Disclosures. These include disputes with customers and disciplinary events. It can also include pending actions and unproven allegations. For brokers who have not been registered in over a decade, the report generally includes the same things. The main difference on this report is the events included in the disclosure action must be ones the broker was found at fault for. The report for brokerage firms will include a report summary describing the firm, a firm profile that lists those who have a controlling interest or direct influence on the day-to-day operations, firm history related to mergers, acquisitions, or name changes that affect the firm, firm operations, such as firm licenses and registrations, what type of business it engages in or expect to be engaged in, and whether it's currently suspended by any regulator. Disclosures include arbitration awards and disciplinary events. This can include pending actions and unproven allegations. Report for investment advisors. On its site, Broker Check offers very limited information about investment advisor representatives and their firm, unless they are also brokers or brokerage firms. Investment advisors will only have basic information like name and address listed. For more information, Broker Check will direct you to the advisors page on the SEC IAPD site. On some Broker Check reports, you may see a notation indicating a matter is under dispute. FINRA allows brokers and firms to dispute information they deem incorrect on their reports. In order to submit a dispute, individuals and firms must complete and sign a dispute form and provide supporting documentation. Then FINRA will determine the merits. According to FINRA, disputes are eligible only if they are related to factual information rather than matters that are open to interpretation. If the information is found to be inaccurate, FINRA will update, modify, or delete the dispute information. Once the matter is resolved, the dispute notification will be removed from the report. The expungement process has attracted controversy, with some criticizing it for shielding brokers from legitimate allegation. Those who support the process praise it for its ability to protect brokers from unfounded allegations. FINRA also offers two databases that the public can use in addition to BrokerCheck, one that tracks arbitrations, awards, and others that monitor disciplinary action. It also has a list of brokers who have been barred from FINRA. You can also check with state security regulators to get additional information about brokers and their investment advisors. Although BrokerCheck reports do include a disclosure section, there is information that section doesn't include, such as details brokers haven't reported or are not obligated to report. These can include civil litigation unrelated to investments, customer complaints that don't involve a sales practice violation, fraud, or theft, non-investment-related misdemeanor charges or convictions, arrests that didn't lead to any charge or conviction. It can be helpful to do a quick internet search to make sure all the necessary details before choosing to work with a broker or a brokerage firm. Next, I thought there's an article also from NerdWallet. This is dated June 11, 2021. Spencer Tierney is the author, and the title is, What is Crypto Banking? Okay, cryptocurrency, crypto for short, is a digital form of currency exchange. Bitcoin and Ethereum have widespread appeal. The current term crypto banking is relatively new and can take a few different forms. Generally, the way people interact with cryptocurrency is by investing. They can involve buying and selling digital currency on a trading platform. Traditional banking, on the other hand, is focused on managing cash and credit at a bank, such as checking and savings accounts and loans. Crypto banking can refer to managing digital currency at a financial technology firm or financial service provider. These banking services can include simply holding a balance, making payments with a crypto debit card, and even earning interest involving one or more cryptocurrencies. And at least one bank has integrated crypto into its products. Crypto banking is a growing and quickly evolving concept. Here's a closer look at some of its key aspects. To manage cryptocurrency, you first need to buy it. And to do that, you need a crypto wallet, which holds proof of your digital assets. Many companies that let you buy crypto can also hold it on your behalf in their free crypto wallets. If you use a crypto exchange such as Coinbase or a financial tech firm such as PayPal, buying crypto can be straightforward. You can pay in U.S. dollars and receive the equivalent value in a digital currency you choose. You can view your balance as you would a bank investment or an account balance for savings. Depending on the company, you may also be able to send and receive crypto from others. Choose where you buy crypto carefully. Some companies, such as PayPal and SoFi, don't let you withdraw crypto from their platforms, so you must sell it to use those funds in order to be able to move it elsewhere. Crypto holders who plan to use multiple platforms or Bitcoin ATMs for in-person transactions should consider a crypto wallet that provides storage on a software personally hosted on their computer or portable device. Such wallets let you make transactions without needing a company to confirm them. Peer-to-peer payment companies Square and PayPal let customers buy, sell, and hold cryptocurrencies alongside any balance held in U.S. dollars. Banking technology firms Revolut, R-E-V-O-L-U-T, and SoFi have similar offerings. PayPal also lets you pay for online purchases with crypto balance, which means you sell the currency back to PayPal at checkout. Since these companies have established presence with mainstream banking services, they may be easy starting points to explore crypto. But watch your transaction fees and limits. Square's Cash App, for example, offers purchases of Bitcoin only, while PayPal and others offer three or four more cryptocurrencies. Unlike nearly all the U.S. banks, Quantic, Quontic Bank, provides a way for customers to get Bitcoin. In December 2020, the bank launched a Bitcoin rewards checking account. Few banks offer rewards checking options, and when they do, they typically provide interest or cash back. On Quantic, when you make a debit card purchase, 1.5% of the transaction amount in U.S. dollars gets converted into Bitcoin and managed by a third-party firm. There's no maximum you can earn. The account has no monthly fees, and your money is dollars is FDI. Your money in dollars is FDI insured. Keep in mind, that's dollars, not the Bitcoin. The nice thing about Bitcoin rewards checking is that you're not risking your own money. So if Bitcoin goes down, you haven't lost anything, says Stephen Chenal, CEO of Quantic Bank. Curious about the bank? There's an article in it. There's a link in NerdWallet directly to it with the review. You can't withdraw the Bitcoin to use elsewhere. Instead, you redeem it in dollars, which costs a 2% fee. The account is available in 27 states and Washington, D.C. What are Bitcoin interest accounts? Versions of a savings account, generally called a crypto interest account. These firms do something similar to what transactional banks do, but with crypto instead of dollars. The firm borrows the money in your savings account to make a loan to other customers and pay the interest in return. While the national average for traditional bank savings account is barely above zero, rates in crypto interest accounts can be 8 to 12% annually. If that sounds too good to be true, consider the risk and complexity around cryptocurrency. Rates can change with market demand, and when a cryptocurrency drops in value, you can lose more money than you earn in interest. Comparing APY isn't as intuitive as with traditional savings accounts, where all the accounts use the same currency, and consider fees and how long it will take to withdraw money back into U.S. dollars, especially since you're lending out what is your crypto interest account. If you're lending out your crypto, you have to be dedicated to educating yourself, says Leah Jones, head of global partnership at Celsius, a crypto marketplace that offers loans and interest accounts. Because it's such a new and volatile currency, there are some inherent risks involved with managing your crypto. Your crypto is not protected by the FDIC, that's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or SIPC, the Securities Investors Protection Corporation, if the company you buy fails. For a bank account, the FDIC insures up to $250,000, and for a brokerage account, SIPC covers up to $500,000. SIPC coverage excludes losses. Excludes the losses from the market movement. The value of cryptocurrency can fluctuate rapidly. You don't want to put anything into crypto that you can't afford to lose, says Ryan Cole, a certified financial planner and founder of the investment advisors firm Citrine Capital in San Francisco. More banks will likely let customers buy and sell cryptocurrency in the future. Neobank First Boulevard partnered with Visa to plot a similar offering. Financial technology provider Kasasa plans to bring Bitcoin wallets to its network of over 900 community banks and credit unions. Existing crypto platforms, meanwhile, hope to see crypto change the way we bank. The first generation of crypto services like Abra need to eliminate the gaps that still mandate the need for traditional banking. I still need to pay bills. I still need to shop easily online, says Bill Barnyard, founder and CEO of the Crypto Payments. And I think this will be our last article for the evening. Also from NerdWallet, Davina Yakum, March 4th, 2020. It's titled, How to Research Stocks. Stock research can help you evaluate a company and decide whether it's worth adding to your portfolio. Researching stock is a lot like shopping for a car. You can base a decision solely on technical specs, but it's also important to consider how the ride feels on the road, the manufacturer's reputation, and whether the color of the interior will camouflage your dog hair. Investors have a name for that type of research, fundamental analysis. What that means, looking at a range of factors such as a company's financial leadership team and competition to evaluate a stock and decide whether it deserves a parking spot in your portfolio. One note before you dive in. Oh, four key ways to evaluate stock. One note before you dive in. Stocks are considered long-term investments because they carry quite a bit of risk. You need time to weather ups and downs and benefit from long-term gains. That means investing is best for money you don't need, at least for the next 5 years. Gather your stock research material. Start by reviewing the company's financial. This is called the quantitative research, and it begins with pulling together a few documents that companies are required to file, a Form K10K, an annual report that includes key financial statements that have been independently audited. Here you can review a company's balance sheet, its source of income, and how it handles its cash and its revenue and expenses. A Form 10Q. It's a quarterly update on operation and financial results. Short on time, you'll find highlights about these filings and important financial ratios on your brokerage firm website or major financial news websites. Narrow your focus. These financial reports contain a ton of information that's easily to get bogged down. Zero in on the following line items to become more familiar with the measurable inner workings of your company. Revenue. This is the amount the money a company brought in during a specific period. It's the first thing that we'll see on an income statement, which is why they often refer to it as the top line. Sometimes revenue is broken down into operating revenue and non-operating revenue. Operating revenue is most telling because it's generated from the company's core business. Non-operating revenue often comes from a one-time business activity such as selling an asset. Net income, the bottom line figure. So-called because it lists at the end of the income statement. It's the total amount of money money a company has made after operating expenses, taxes, and depreciation have subtracted from revenue. Revenue is the equivalent of your gross salary, and the net income is comparable to what's left after you've paid taxes and living expenses. Earnings and earnings per share, EPS. When you divide earnings by the number of shares available to trade, you get an earnings per share. This number shows the company's profitability on a per share basis, which makes it easier to compare with other companies when you see earnings per share showed by TTM. That refers to trailing 12 months. Earning is far from a perfect financial statement measurement because it doesn't tell you how effectively the company uses its capital. Some companies take those earnings and reinvest them in business. Others cut them out, pay them out to shareholders in the form of dividends. Price per share, price earnings ratio, PE. Dividing a company's current stock price by its earnings per share, usually over the last 12 months, gives you a company's PE ratio. Dividing the stock price by forecasting earnings from Wall Street analysis gives you the forward PE. This measure of the stock value tells you how much investors are willing to pay to receive a dollar of the company's current earnings. Keep in mind that PE ratio is derived from potentially flawed earnings per share calculations, and analyst estimates are notoriously focused on the short term. Therefore, it's not the most reliable standalone metric. Return on equity, ROE, and return on assets, ROA. Return on equity reveals in percentage form how much profit a company generates with each dollar shareholders have invested. This equity is shareholder equity. Return on assets shows what percentage of its profits the company generates with each dollar of its assets. Each is derived from dividing the company's annual net income by one of these measures. These percentages also tell you something about how efficient the company is at generating profits. Here again, beware of the gotchas. A company can artificially boost return on equity by buying back shares to reduce the shareholder equity denominator. Similarly, taking on more debt, say loans to increase inventory or finance property, increase the amount of assets used to calculate return on assets. Turn to a qualitative research. If qualitative research or quantitative research reveals the black and white financials of a company story, qualitative research provides the technicolor details that give you a truer picture of its operations and prospects. Warren Buffett famously said, buy into a company because you want to own it, not because you want the stock to go up. That's because when you buy stocks, you purchase a personal stake in business. Here are some questions to help you screen your potential business partners. How does the company make money? Sometimes it's obvious, such as a clothing retailer whose main business is selling clothes. Sometimes it's not, such as a fast food company that derives most of its revenue from selling franchises, or an electronic firm that relies on providing consumer financing for growth. A good rule of thumb is, does the company have a competitive advantage? Look for something about the business that makes it difficult to imitate, equal, or eclipse. This could be its brand's business model, ability to innovate, research capabilities, patent ownership, operational excellence, or superior distribution capabilities, to name a few. The harder it is for a competitor to breach the company's moat, the stronger the competitive advantage. How good is the management team? The company's only as good as its leaders' ability to plot a course and steer the enterprise. You can find out a lot about its management by reading their words and transcripts in the company's conference calls and annual reports. Also, research the company's board of directors. These people represent the shareholders in the boardroom. Be wary of boards comprised mainly of company insiders. You want to see a healthy number of independent thinkers who can objectively assess management's actions. What could go wrong? We're not talking about development that might affect the company's stock price in the short term, but fundamental changes that affect the business ability to grow over many years. Identify potential red flags. Use the what-if scenario. An important patent expires. The CEO's successor starts taking the business in a different direction. A viable competitor emerges. New technology usurps the company's product or service. And put your research into context. As you can see, these are endless matrix and ratio investors can use to assess a company's general financial health and calculate the intrinsic value of stock. But looking solely at a company's revenue for income, long-term partnership, and to do that, context is key. All right. Seems we've come to the end. We've run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you enjoyed it. And be sure to listen next time. I'm Jenna Walker, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired.